This is VOCM News Talk. Call 709-273-5211 or 1-888-590-8626. The views and opinions of this program are not necessarily those of this station. Here's VOCM News Talk host Linda Swain.
And good afternoon, everyone, on this spring-like day here in VOCM Valley. What a beautiful afternoon. It's turning out to be nice and warm for sure. Well, you won't have to turn your heaters up, at least not now, and that's a good thing because the federal carbon tax increase is set to take effect in just a few weeks' time, April the 1st. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has received a letter from the premier of this province who's asked him to consider putting a pause on that increase. VOCM's Richard Duggan and other reporters were at Confederation Building yesterday and spoke with the premier about why he wrote the letter. Here's how that went.
As you've heard me say many times before, we don't think that the carbon tax is the right instrument at this time, especially given the inflationary pressures that exist for families across the province. I've made that opinion well known for several years now. And given the deadline that's coming up in April with respect to a future increase in the carbon tax, we felt it was wise to express our opinion once again that this isn't the right instrument at this time for the people of Newfoundland and Labrador. I know that the federal government suggests that that there is a rebate, and while we're grateful for that, it doesn't fully contemplate the induced and indirect costs of living on an island or living in rural and remote areas for goods and services necessarily one for one. And that is of concern to us. Combined with the clean fuel standards that came into place, it's a significant inflationary pressure point. And with respect to the motives and the incentive behind the carbon tax, we just don't think it's the right instrument at this time for the people of Newfoundland and Labrador. Yeah, of course. But we've done it. You can check the record. We sent many different letters on this. It is scheduled to increase. We've seen the federal government in the past change tact, whether that's on home heat, which we argued for before the winter started to get the carbon tax removed from the home heat, or in something a little different in terms of the bear tax. But this one, we felt, given the timelines of the scheduled raise in the tax, that it was appropriate to express our opinion yet once again for all the same reasons that I've already discussed.
Do you have much hope that this time there will be the change that you're looking for?
There definitely won't be any change if we don't express our opinion. So whether or not it's the people in Ottawa contemplate our opinion or not, I'll defer to them. But I would suggest that it has been successful in the past with respect to home heat in particular. We were facing a winter where people were going to be subject to home heat and the carbon tax on home heat, which could have been crippling for especially seniors or people on fixed income. So they have listened in the past. There continues to be inflationary pressures that, take a year or two to work through everybody's personal budgets and family budgets, and we ask them to reflect on that and what this raise will mean to the people of Newfoundland and Labrador. So the solutions are to continue to work with industry to reduce their carbon footprint, and we've been successful here in Newfoundland and Labrador. I'm very proud of our offshore petroleum industry and leading really the rest of Canada with the reduction in emissions and their carbon footprint of their platforms. I think we should all celebrate that. So that's one way that we can do more as a government, and as when the federal government looks at how they can have a role to play, looking at their ability to work with industry and use any revenues generated to support the electrical infrastructure required for changing to electric vehicles or changing to away from oil and gas to the sources of electricity is important. But that infrastructure doesn't exist here in Newfoundland and Labrador. It doesn't exist across many places in Canada. Many people obviously live in the GTA, Vancouver, Montreal, but that is certainly not a cross-section of Canada, and we need to make sure that everything is in place to support those who want to change, those who want to play a role, a personal role in their own family lives of how they can deal with climate change by limiting their own carbon footprint. But the government can have a role to establish the infrastructure required. By the way, no different than governments played a role when they were building railways and highways. This is a role that government can play in establishing the infrastructure to allow the people of the country to make that wise choice to change.
So that's some of what Andrew Furey had to say to reporters yesterday after he fired a letter off to the Prime Minister asking that pause be put on the plans to increase the federal carbon tax as of April the 1st. As you know, it's being brought in and increased steadily in phases. Well, the federal minister, François-Philippe Champagne, indicated he has no intention of delaying or scrapping the scheduled increase expected April the 1st. Here's a portion of his conversation with Vassy Capellos of CTV's Power Play, and we're using this, of course, with Vassy's permission.
Listen, I like Premier Fury. I've known him for a long time, but I think we have been very clear that a price on pollution is the right thing to do. It brings more money in the pocket of Canadians. That vision, that approach has been clear from the start. The Prime Minister has been clear. I hear his voice, but I think that, you know, we have a plan to fight climate change. We have been clear with Canadians all along. And honestly, I think that Canadians understand that. The plan is working. It's going to bring more money in the pockets of Canadians. And we're going to continue to do that because, you know what, this is an investment in the future. This is an investment that has allowed us also to attract investment in Canada because people see these Canadians are serious about fighting climate change. So I would be happy to engage with Premier Fury. I'll see him soon. But I can tell you we're going to continue to do what's right for the country, not only now, but for the future.
Minister, though, the Premier's point is that he is not, like you characterize many of your opponents on the carbon tax, against the issue of mitigating climate change, that he takes it very seriously. But at the same time, people in Newfoundland and Labrador and many of the other provinces in which this carbon tax applies are dealing with a high rate of inflation, high interest rates, and he's simply asking your government to pause the increase until interest rates go down and inflation stabilizes. Why won't you at least consider that? Are you so ideologically wedded to it that you can't listen to the premiers who are saying it is adding to the burden of the cost of living for the people who live in their provinces?
Listen, I understand the issue around cost of living, Vashi. I've been the one with colleagues who have been fighting all along to make sure that life is more affordable for Canadians. I took on, for example, the grocery sector and the big chains to make sure that people can afford grocery. I keep on that fight. I'm going to even bring that at the G7 meeting that I'm going this evening to make sure that we start seeing competition issues, making sure that life is more affordable. I get that. You know, I come from rural Canada. I know that people talk to me. But at the same time, people that I meet in the street understand that we need also to be fighting climate change, that the price on pollution is the best way. It's been tested to make sure that, you know, we have the right framework to make sure that we drive the right behavior, but at the same time, that we send the money back in the pocket of Canadians. So this is a system that it's working, and Canadians understand that.
Respectfully, Minister, do Canadians actually see that it's working? The Auditor General pointed out that your government has not attached a specific emissions reductions target to the price on carbon, that you have not produced evidence. The NDP Premier of Manitoba said the same thing. The people associated with the provincial NDP in both Saskatchewan and Alberta have raised the same concerns. Now your Liberal colleague is also calling into a question exactly what you're trying to argue. Even the Parliamentary Budget Officer has said when you take into account all the indirect costs, slightly more Canadians are worse off than better off because of the carbon tax. Again, why are you so ideologically wedded to it that you can't just wait until inflation stabilizes and press pause for a moment?
Listen, it's not about ideology. It's about the planet. Vashi, I'd say that the fact that we have a plan to fight climate change has brought billions of investment in this country. People understand, you know, we set ourselves to be the green supply of choice to the world, whether it's green aluminum, green steel, green batteries, green semiconductor. That's what we're known for. This has attracted investment and make sure that, you know, we position Canada as a leader in the world. And decarbonizing industries is a trend. Look in Alberta. We have Heidelberg, for example. We're going to have the first green cement plant in the world. Dow Chemical decided to put their plant in Fort Saskatchewan, Alberta. Why? Because they want to have the greenest propylene plant in the world. So that system is working. It's bringing money in the pockets of Canadians. And I think the vast majority of Canadians agree that we need to keep on and fighting climate change. It's the right thing to do for the planet. It's the right thing to do for our kids. And we can do it in a sensible way, making sure that we drive the right behavior that gives money back in the pockets of Canadians. I respect my colleagues. You know, I talk with all the premiers in Canada, for sure. But at the same time, we need to make sure that we take the right decision for now, but also for the future of this nation.
So that's a little of what François-Philippe Champagne had to say to Vassi Kapelos on CTV's Power Play. And we used that bit of audio with Vassi's permission. We reached out to her today to see if she was okay with that, and she was. So it doesn't sound like there's any change coming there. If you have any thoughts on that, you are certainly welcome to give us a call. We'll be back right after the break. We're going to hear from VOCM's Richard Duggan, who is stuck quite literally at Confederation Building. We'll tell you why when we come back right after this.
Stay informed and have your say on the news of the day with your VOCM. Join Linda Swain weekday afternoons from 4 to 5 p.m. for an hour of talk and discussion with decision makers and listeners like you. News Talk on your VOCM.
And we are back. And as you know, fish harvesters have been attending question period in the House of Assembly since the spring sitting began last week. And they've been in the public gallery and until very recently have made their presence there known, primarily during question period in response to particular questions and answers on the floor of the House of Assembly. Now, yesterday, as you recall, they were ejected from the public gallery where you're not supposed to be making public utterances or even standing up for that matter. So they were ejected by the Speaker of the House, and question period was temporarily recessed while that was going on. Well, today there were no real outbursts from the public gallery, but something very different is happening. VOCM's Richard Duggan is in the parking lot at Confederation Building. Richard, what's happening?
Yeah, so Linda, fish harvesters from all across the province are here at Confederation Building to listen to this debate that's going on right now about the fishery. It's all about a private members resolution that was brought forward by the PCs in regard to the fishery. Now, while that's happening, the public gallery is full of fish harvesters, and the fish harvesters are also outside. They have a speaker set up where they're all sort of gathered around listening to the debate. And part of this is that they all have their vehicles, their trucks and whatnot. They're lining the main laneway at Confederation Building, which evidently has blocked myself and a few of the other media into the parking lot of Confederation Building. So we're all stuck in limbo now while the fish harvesters are sat around intently listening to this debate. I know that they were having a little bit of technical difficulties with the audio feed to the outside portion, but that's where things stand right now. It's quite an interesting scene to look at in the Confederation Building lobby.
So you are unable to get back here to the studio and process all the news of the day. Are they saying anything to you?
No, we've gone around. Not a whole lot being said right now. Again, they're all just waiting and listening intently to see. And again, it all comes back to there's a bunch of issues in the fishery that everyone is sort of looking at. But of course, this main one now is getting the boats on the water, and that has to do with the deal that's currently in discussion between the AFP and the FFAW. We were told by the premier today after question period that offers have been exchanged, and the two sides did meet again today. So, but again, that everyone is just sort of waiting now on this deal and to see when they can go on the water and for how much money. So that's where it all sort of stands right now.
And so are you there for the long haul? What happens?
I guess so, yeah, because there, I mean, there's no room and really for anybody to back up without like a lot of people having to move their vehicles. So I guess we're sort of, we're here until they leave, I guess is the best way to put it.
And is there any security or police presence there?
There is a police presence. I'm not sure about what it's looking like right now up in the gallery itself. I know there were two police officers there during question period. But I know as of right now, there are two police officers stood on the top of the stairs at Confederation Building. Again, there's nothing really happening. Everybody's just listening to the debate. There's no, not even any chants or anything like that. It's pretty quiet and calm, actually. But, you know, there are two police officers that are stood on the top of the stairs just overseeing and making sure that nothing does happen.
And anyone holding signs or anything?
No signs. They have had a couple of big signs kind of off to the side on the stairs. Those have been there, I think, since yesterday when we were there talking about the need for free enterprise. So those two signs are there. But in terms of like fish harvesters actively holding signs, there isn't any of that at the moment.
Well, Richard, I hope you're able to get clear of that soon. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Linda.
Thank you. VOCM's Richard Duggan at Confederation Building, unable to move as we speak. He and other reporters unable to leave the parking lot there because of the just the volume of vehicles and the presence of fish harvesters there who are sitting down listening to the debate in the House of Assembly. Well, one of the partners with GC Strategies testified today before the Government Operations Committee about the ArriveCan app. That's the contentious app, of course, that the Federal Auditor General raised some very serious concerns about. But as you will hear, Christian Firth was clearly upset about the attention generated by the company's multi-million dollar contract with the federal government. Here's what Christian Firth had to say in his opening statement this morning after being compelled to testify before the committee.
This is my third time before the committee. I've been compelled to be here. The last month, virtually everything reported about my company in the media and stated about me and my company has been false. I have submitted to the committee a complete list of all contracts we've been awarded from the government in our history. I have included the nominal value of the contract and, more importantly, the full amounts we have invoiced the government under those contracts. We have also included the total amount we have paid our subcontractors under those contracts. And as you can see, the amounts paid to GC Strategies are not the astronomical amount being claimed by some committee members. Since my last appearance before you, this committee has summoned many departments and their representatives with whom we have had dealings. The committee informed each of these representatives that we were criminals, forgers, and fraudulent. The committee said that if they did not terminate all our contracts and suspend our ability to obtain contracts, that they were negligent and complicit in misusing taxpayer money. The committee also strongly encouraged each department to refer these matters to the RCMP. As a result, and not surprisingly, each department complied, terminating our agreements and our ability to continue government work. In addition, they have confirmed the matters have been requested and referred to the RCMP for investigation. As a result, although I welcome an independent investigation, for it will exonerate me, and the committee has not chosen to wait for the results of that investigation, I will not be able to answer questions about the matters referred to the RCMP. I trust you'll understand. GC Strategies has appeared before this committee twice, giving hours of testimony. We have also cooperated throughout the entire study and provided all documentation requested of us. We have been portrayed as reluctant witnesses by some committee members and media. However, the truth is we've always been accessible, willing to answer committee members' questions in writing. The committee has not once reached out for a response to question. Instead, the committee exercised the most extreme measures and we had the full weight of the government come down on us, compelling us to be here by subpoena, knowing full well this is against medical advice as outlined in our doctor's notes we have provided as part of the evidence package. I'm certain any medical professional would attest that the threat of arrest and detainment would cause undue stress. Since our first publicized appearance, myself and my business partner have received hundreds of threatening and abusive emails, all of which have been documented and they have been shared. I would read these aloud, but to be frank, they are vile and not suitable for any audience. The nature of these communications, threatening our lives and the lives of our family and children, and have given rise to our reasonable ask for future appearances to not be televised. The chair unanimously and without justification denied our request, intent on isolating Mr. Anthony and myself from one another and broadcasting to the result of the widest possible audience. Over the past few months, we've had images of our homes and the addresses of our personal dwellings published across media titles, journalists turning up to our private property, confronting family members, and our young children approached, and their privacy violated with strangers taking photographs of them whilst in the hockey changing rooms. Surely the members of this committee can agree this isn't acceptable output from this process. We offered to appear in public, but requested not to be televised over these concerns. We were rejected, we've been separated, and we're being televised. We can only conclude that this televised nature of today's meeting aids in political goal scoring while simultaneously using us as media fodder at the expense of our health and the safety of our families. This is either fair nor reasonable. I've shown up and will answer questions to the best of my ability, but may require frequent breaks. I will answer questions for as long as I am able, but cannot guarantee I will be able to make it all the way through. Thank you.
So that is Christian Firth of GC Strategies, who accuses this whole process, the Government Operations Committee, of being nothing more than political goal scoring. And he was quite clear in his opening statement that he was none too pleased to be going through that process. Yet again, he says this is the third time they have testified before the federal government. Anyway, if you have any thoughts on that, you're welcome to give us a call. Also says that the amount of money that is being reported as going towards the ArriveCan app is much lower than the actual amount is much lower than what is being reported. Well, for the first time in decades, the Capelin stock is out of the critical zone. We'll take you to a DFO announcement this morning, right after the break, with VOCM News and Sarah Strickland. This is News Talk on VOCM.
Saturday morning, join us for the Irish Newfoundland Show. Send your request to IrishNL at VOCM.com or submit them online at VOCM.com.
Work. And we are back, and we're going to go to our callers now. Dan, in the Bay of Islands, I should say, is on line one. Hello, Dan.
Good day. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good.
What's on your mind?
I was thinking, you know, about the fish harvesters are protesting, and I understand they got to protest. It's the only way they're going to get anywhere. But one of the things they want to do is to be able to sell the product off the island. In my opinion, I think that is a bad idea, because if they start selling product off the island, that's going to affect the local fish plants, and they won't be, you know, last year was a big concern about the hours on the crab fishery for the plant workers. And if they start selling off the island, now you got the plant workers not going to be working at all, rather than having a delay start or anything like that. And are they considering that they're going to be putting people out of work?
And that's the very crux of the debate here. And it was raised in the House of Assembly as well. Indeed, what does happen to the plant workers? Because the reason why ostensibly until now you couldn't sell to outside buyers is to ensure that people are employed here and that local plant workers are able to employ local people. And it could be argued from the harvester perspective of things, it could be argued that this is part of the imbalance, I suppose, in power, because in essence, fish harvesters are business owners. They're small enterprise owners, and they have a big debt, and there's big money at stake, and they feel hemmed in and beholden to just about everyone without, you know, any real say, which is why we see these things happen year after year after year. So yes, you're raising an absolutely essential point in all of this, is that if harvesters are allowed to buy to outside processors, well, what happens here then?
Yeah, it's a big picture that I don't think they're fully looking at.
Indeed. And, you know, only so many fish people who work in the fish processing industry are unionized. A large number are not. So, you know, those people have a say and a voice as well. It's got to be a concern to a lot of people, and especially women who make up the bulk of processing workers.
Yeah, and it will definitely be a big impact on the economy because these workers, they, you know, granted they do have a short work term, but now if they have no work, then it's, you know, those jobs that are totally lost.
Well, we'll see how this unfolds in the next couple of days. Don, I really appreciate your call.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for listening, and I hope the harvesters listen a little bit and take that into consideration.
All right. Are you do you work in a fish processing plant yourself?
No, I have nothing to do with the fishery.
Ah, very good.
To be honest.
All right. Well, Don, I appreciate your call. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. And your thoughts on that, you're welcome to give us a call. Well, for the first time in decades, the capelin stock is out of the critical zone, but similar to northern cod stocks, that just reflects changes in how stocks are being assessed. The Department of Fisheries and Oceans has changed its limit reference point for capelin stocks, meaning that the capelin are no longer in the critical zone, but research scientist Hannah Murphy warns that doesn't mean that capelin are more plentiful. Here's some of what she had to say today.
We have not determined the cautious and healthy zones yet, so that is also an important factor to consider. But at this point, the capelin stock is above its limit reference point.
We'll start with Gary Keane with Saltwire.
Why do you think that the capelin are maturing at a younger age, or does it just mean that they're not getting a chance to be older, so you're not seeing, that's why you're not seeing the older ones?
It is basically they're just not getting a chance to grow older. So since these young fish now, there's not as much competition for food, they're growing fast and reaching the size of maturation. And since, you know, 100% of males, about 100% of males die after their first spawning, and up to 80% of females die. So at age 2 to 3, they're just dying. And so we're not seeing these old 4, 5, 6-year-old fish anymore. It's because of their spawning behavior.
So is there a reason why they're not getting a chance to get older?
I think they're just taking advantage of less competition for food. Their population strategy has changed. They're just growing fast, and then they're wanting to lay their eggs, and that's their new strategy.
What kind of an impact are seals having on capelin?
Capelin is an important prey for seals as well as many higher trophic level predators. From our from the work in the science branch here, it's finfish predators like northern cod definitely take a larger share. They consume more capelin than seals. But in the end, the stock itself is driven by bottom-up drivers like the environment. So that is really what's impacting year class strength. And the impact of seals is considered to be a lower impact.
So that is a research scientist with DFO, Hannah Murphy, explaining some of the factors involved in capelin growth. Capelin growing faster, maturing faster, and of course dying at younger ages as a result, because most capelin die after they spawn. So they're reaching spawning age at a much younger age, about 2 years old now, instead of the typical 4, which was the case many years ago. Very curious as to why they're doing that. They just seem to have adopted it as a environmental strategy, if you will. And if you have any thoughts on that, you're welcome to give us a call. Well, the minister responsible for public procurement is extolling the virtues of government's new approach to inking contracts for goods and services. Two new procurement strategies were recently announced with a focus on maximizing use of provincial suppliers and hiring local first, all with an emphasis on sustainability. John Abbott addressed the St. John's Board of Trade this morning. Here's some of what he had to say.
In 2018, government introduced new public procurement legislation to modernize government's procurement policies. All of our 500 public bodies within the province are required to follow this legislation when procuring goods, services, as well as when we do our construction. And we will be entering a very busy season now. We'll be announcing a roads plan later on this week. And obviously our construction sector will be very engaged on procurement through our tendering process. The legislation fundamentally changed the approach to procurement from the traditional lowest price approach to one that now mandates that public bodies achieve best value. And this is defined in the legislation as the best balance of cost, quality, performance, and support. The legislation gives public bodies flexibility to enable them to choose the appropriate procurement tool to ensure best value is achieved. This makes sense, as that's how most of us, obviously, buy the things we need, whether at home or in our businesses. But of course, there's going to be always critics as to that approach. And one thing I have known over the years, the critics that we do hear from most are those, obviously, who haven't been successful in the first round. But we want to address that as well. So instead of buying a vehicle, and we do a lot of that, based on the lowest price, now we look at the total cost of ownership, its fuel efficiency, and its environmental impacts. In addition to having a more flexible approach to procurement, the legislation also includes measures to benefit suppliers, such as a requirement to provide debriefings to unsuccessful suppliers or bidders, and a supplier complaint process. This latter element is critical to ensure fairness and transparency. Just this past week, I was asked to look at a certain tender where the specifications too specific that could thwart firms from actually bidding. Our review determined that, in fact, the tender was too specific, and revised tender was issued. During the first years of the new legislation, we were focused on training for procurement officials, and training continues to this day. But now we are shifting our focus to provide greater support to our suppliers. In 2020, we introduced an electronic procurement system, and our public openings are now available online, making the procurement process more accessible to suppliers right across the province. Also in 2020, we introduced new provisions to help support local suppliers. First, we had introduced a local preference provision to the public. We added those to the public procurement regulations to mandate an allowance of 10% for provincial suppliers for all procurements to the maximum permitted under Canada Free Trade Agreement. And that agreement is the overriding sort of authority for our province and all provinces. Now, as a result of this provincial preference discount policy, the public procurement agency has awarded 81 contracts valued at approximately $696,000 to provincial suppliers. And these contracts otherwise would have gone out of province to other suppliers. Now, there is a cost to doing that, but it is a minimal cost. In this case, it costs the provincial treasury, quote unquote, $33,000. And we believe that was a small price to pay for local content and maintaining local jobs. Additionally, the thresholds for open call bids were increased to allow for more opportunities to direct business to local suppliers through a limited call process. Now, we haven't stopped there. Following these changes, the procurement agency continued to review our legislation, our regulations, and our policies in order to identify opportunities to improve local preference. And they consulted with the local supplier community as part of this review. Now, based on this review and the consultations we undertook, I was very pleased to introduce the Newfoundland and Labrador First procurement strategy. And the focus is on Newfoundland and Labrador First, which will help maximize the success of provincial suppliers in obtaining government contracts and support provincial supplier development. Now, there have been a lot of conversations over the years, and I was involved in those inside and outside government, as to how we can enhance local preference. in the most positive and constructive way without minimizing competition. And we also need to bring in suppliers and firms from the from outside the province, obviously, to make us even more competitive. So it's been an ongoing challenge. So through the work that the agency did in its consultations, and then when I arrived in the department, we had very good conversations, and we were able then last fall to bring these ideas and recommendations to the provincial cabinet, and they bought in.
So that's John Abbott addressing the St. John's Board of Trade this morning when it comes to public procurement and some of the changes that government has made in that process. When we come back, Haiti's Prime Minister, if you've been watching the news out of the Caribbean as of late, Haiti's Prime Minister has resigned as law and order collapses in the Caribbean nation. Karen Huckster is the founder and director of a children's aid mission in Haiti, but she's been unable to return there for the last number of years just because it's simply too dangerous. We'll speak with Huckster when we come back right after this. This is News Talk on VOCM.
Nutrition, exercise, keeping the cold at bay. Whatever keeps you feeling great, the Wellness and Healthy Lifestyle Show on your VOCM.
And we are back. Well, Haiti's Prime Minister has resigned as law and order collapses in the Caribbean nation. And Karen Huckster is the founder and director of a children's aid mission in Haiti, but she has been unable to return to the place she calls her second home because it's simply too dangerous. Huckster is watching the unfolding situation with great concern and anxiety from her home in Springdale, and she joins me now. Well, Karen Huckster, you're so intimately familiar with Haiti. You must be watching with great distress about the latest developments there.
Yes, I'm very much so, correctly said. I've only seen to watch a couple of things that are now the media is finally mentioning. I've seen that with great interest, but I have been in touch regularly. I know what's been going on all the time, and it's upsetting, but there's not much I can do. My assistant, but I had him elevated to director like myself, co-directors now. He's on the ground, and he's Haitian, and he's taking care of things the very best that he can. He's working very hard to keep the children safe, to see that they're fed. He still has our school running, which he's been in charge of since day one, because he is definitely an educator. But it's not easy for them. Not easy at all. The children can't live on the mission that I founded. Until things change in the country, if it will, and I keep believing it will. I have to believe that way. So they cannot go back there to live because there's two gangs, one on each side of our area, that have moved in. And so him and the children are kind of boxed in, along with a lot of other people. And so his thoughts, and I agree with him, if the children are on the site, laughing, talking, having a lot of fun, it can be heard outside the mission, and the gangs go by there often and just park and listen to see if there's anybody on site so he doesn't let them be there. It's not easy.
Certainly. You've called Haiti your second home. Have you been back there recently?
No, I can't get back. It's been too dangerous. Because this has been going on for a long time and building up and building up. And last time I went down, I took my Haitian adopted son I have here. We went down in 2020. And we had gone for about 5 months, between 4.5 and 5 months. I thought I would keep one extra month we're allowed out of Canada with my boy for the summer to go back. So we went thinking we'd be there almost 5 months, and we were there 2 months when I get a call from my two daughters saying, get out, get on the plane, get out, because of COVID. And I was saying, what or who is COVID? I was in there with no TV and no radio. I didn't have anything. So they made me realize there was no one in that country could help me if I had a health problem. So I had to get out. So we returned home in 2 months instead of five. And it's been so dangerous that we haven't been able to get back. The mission is a 2.5-hour drive from Port-au-Prince. But you have to go through Port-au-Prince, a good portion of it. And the gangs have been around the airport. I wouldn't even get out of the airport. I wouldn't get very far. I would have been kidnapped. And who knows? So I haven't been able to get back.
Karen Huckster, very distressing. We hope that things will stabilize there in the near future. I really do appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you very much.
And Karen Huckster runs a mission for orphan children in Haiti, about 2 hours outside of Port-au-Prince. Well, Claudette, do you or have you ever used a neti pot?
No, but I've always seen the commercial and have been kind of just interested for certain family members who I believe should get one.
Well, and whenever I think of neti pot, the first image that comes to mind is from Big Bang Theory with Amy over the sink, you know?
Oh!
Anyway, so in essence, it looks like a little teapot, right?
Good with analogy.
A
long spout,
and you put it up to one nostril and you hang your head over a sink or something and you just pour the water through, and it goes in through one sinus and out through the other, and it's supposed, the idea is it's supposed to clear out your
nasal passages
and prevent you from getting colds and viruses and the like and all that sort of thing.
So you know something. What do you know? That's evil. What happened?
Well, this may. Now, people who regularly use neti pots are probably already well familiar with, you know, the process that you have to use and the kind of water that you have to use.
Oh, yeah. It would be a specific kind of water. Okay.
But the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention down in the United States has linked a second type of deadly amoeba to nasal rinsing. Scientists have known for years that people who use neti pots can become infected with a brain-eating amoeba if they use common tap water.
Well, you know people are going to do it. They are going to use the tap water,
right? Of course they are.
Yeah.
You know, there's lots of people who would do that rather than, you know, sit down, boil the water or buy distilled water or whatever the case may be. Anyway, don't use tap water. The use of the small teapots with long spouts that are filled with a saline solution and used to drain nasal passages of allergens has boomed in the last couple of decades. Anyone using a neti pot should use boiled, sterile, or distilled saline water.
Okay, so now I'm going to have to live with...
You're going to have to live with whatever it is you're living with. That.
Back at you, Linda.
And we've all been there. So there you have it. I know people who have said, you know, that, you know, they couldn't wait to use those kinds of things. Because, you know, especially here in Newfoundland, apparently we have a very high percentage of people who have, like, sinus infections and stuff here.
And
I don't
too,
know if it's the weather
too.
Or...
Yeah.
What it is, temperature, or like you say, allergens in the air. But apparently we have a very high level of that. So there's lots of people who find this stuff of great interest.
And now you're going to find them all on a Newfoundland buy and sell.
But that's just those little teapot type things that you do kind of do yourself, not, you know, the stuff that you buy or that kind of thing. But it's just the... You know.
But what does that say about the water, right? Like, I mean, we're all drinking it. So I don't know. I know. That's a whole other
anyway,
show, Linda.
Anyway, now you're freaking me out. Anyway, on that note, we'll be back tomorrow. So do join us then. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great evening.